in the Old Testament in the book of Job. This evening we are going to read Zophar's second speech and Job's reply. We shall read chapter 20 now, but look back to the end of Job's last speech in that most wonderful 19th chapter that we looked at last Sunday evening. Verse 28 of chapter 19, Job says to his friends, "If you say, 'How we will hound him, since the root of the trouble lies in him,'" Job says, "you should fear the sword yourselves, for wrath will bring punishment by the sword, and then you will know that there is judgment." Then Zophar the Naamathite replied, "My troubled thoughts prompt me to answer because I am greatly disturbed. I hear a rebuke that dishonors me, and my understanding inspires me to reply. Surely you know," addressing Job, "how it has been from of old, ever since man was placed on the earth, that the mirth of the wicked is brief. The joy of the godless lasts but a moment." Well, it's not necessarily true, is it? But that's what he says. "Though his pride reaches to the heavens and his head touches the clouds, he will perish forever like his own dung. Those who have seen him will say, 'Where is he?' Like a dream he flies away, no more to be found, banished like a vision of the night. The eye that saw him will not see him again. His place will look on him no more. His children must make amends to the poor. His own hands must give back his wealth. The youthful vigor that fills his bones will lie with him in the dust. Though evil is sweet in his mouth and he hides it under his tongue, though he cannot bear to let it go and keeps it in his mouth, yet his food will turn sour in his stomach. It will become the venom of serpents within him. He will spit out the riches he swallowed. God will make his stomach vomit them up. He will suck the poison of serpents. The fangs of an adder will kill him. He will not enjoy the streams, the rivers flowing with honey and cream. What he toiled for, he must give back uneaten. He will not enjoy the profit from his trading, for he has oppressed the poor." You see the implication to poor Job? "For he has oppressed the poor and left them destitute. He has seized houses he did not build. Surely he will have no respite from his craving. He cannot save himself by his treasure. Nothing is left for him to devour. His prosperity will not endure. In the midst of his plenty," and this is Zophar's theme, "in the midst of his plenty, distress will overtake him. The full force of misery will come upon him. When he has filled his belly, God will vent his burning anger against him and rain down his blows upon him. Though he flees from an iron weapon, a bronze-tipped arrow pierces him. He pulls it out of his back, the gleaming point out of his liver. Terrors will come over him. Total darkness lies in wait for his treasures. It's thought here his treasures mean his children. A fire unfanned will consume him and devour what is left in his tent. The heavens will expose his guilt. The earth will rise up against him. A flood will carry off his house, rushing waters on the day of God's wrath. And he concludes, such is the fate God allots the wicked, the heritage appointed for them by God. I intended to read the 21st chapter later on, but I think we'll take it right away. Then Job replied, listen carefully to my words. Let this be the consolation you give me. Bear with me while I speak, and after I have spoken, mock on, he says. Is my complaint directed to man? Why should I not be impatient? Look at me and be astonished. Clap your hand over your mouth. When I think about this, he means his plight, I am terrified. Trembling seizes my body. Why do the wicked live on, growing old and increasing in power? You see how he's contradicting what Zophar has said. Why do the wicked live on, growing old and increasing in power? They see their children established around them, their offspring before their eyes. Their homes are safe and free from fear. The rod of God is not upon them. Their bulls never fail to breed, nor cows calf and do not miscarry. They send forth their children as a flock. Their little ones dance about. They sing to the music of tambourine and harp. They make merry to the sound of the flute. They spend their years in prosperity and go down to the grave in peace. Yet they say to God, leave us alone. We have no desire to know your ways. Who is the Almighty that we should serve him? What would we gain by praying to him? And then Job makes this comment, but their prosperity is not in their own hands. So he says, I stand aloof from the counsel of the wicked. Yet, he resumes, how often is the lamp of the wicked snuffed out? How often does calamity come upon them, the fate God allots in his anger? How often are they like straw before the wind, like chaff swept away by the gale? It is said, God stores up a man's punishment for his sons. But Job says, let him repay the man himself, so that he will know it, and not venge his wrath upon his sons. We'll discuss this later on, touching upon it last night at prayer. Let his own eyes see his destruction. Let him drink of the wrath of the Almighty. For what does he care about the family he leaves behind when his allotted months come to an end? Can anyone teach knowledge to God, since he judges even the highest? One man dies in full vigor, completely secure and at ease, his body well nourished, his bones rich in marrow. Another man dies in bitterness of soul, never having enjoyed anything good. Side by side they lie in the dust, and worms cover them both. And then he goes on, I know full well what you are thinking, the schemes by which you would wrong me. You say, where now is the great man's house, the tents where wicked men lived? Have you never questioned those who travel and have experience of the world, he means? Have you paid no regard to their accounts? That the evil man is spared from the day of calamity, that he is delivered from the day of wrath. Who denounces his conduct to his face? Who repays him for what he has done? He is carried to the grave, and watch is kept over his tomb. The soil in the valley is sweet to him. All men follow after him, and a countless throng goes before him, that is to say, to honor the wicked when he dies, and how true to life that often is. So, says Job in conclusion, how can you console me with your nonsense? Nothing is left of your answers but falsehood. Amen. May God bless to us his holy word. The book of Job in the Old Testament, chapters 20 and 21. Many of Job's words in his magnificent 19th chapter would have riled his three friends. But nonetheless, they are strict in the order of their replies. So it is Zophar's turn now. His thoughts, he says, trouble him to the extent that he's greatly disturbed. He has been rebuked. Think of it. He, Zophar, has been rebuked, and no man who thinks he is it can stand rebuke. It is tantamount to dismissing him as a nonentity. How would you think so? Not at all. To receive correction, even if you think it is undeserved, doesn't necessarily undermine your status as an individual of worth. Unless the critic is completely contemptuous, the rebuke simply means, or may mean, that in his view you have been shown to be wrong in one point. And the best people make mistakes. No one on earth is so perfect that he does not merit rebuke at some time or other, our blessed Lord apart, of course. But the person who is filled with conceit regards even the slightest question as to his words or deeds as equivalent to writing him off as a person of worth. No. To receive rebuke or correction, even if you do not agree with it, shouldn't undermine confidence to the extent that one feels demoralized. But Zophar couldn't stand it. He said it dishonored him. Which is nonsense. As we see, when true friends disagree on many things and yet show no lack of confidence in each other. So, out of the depths of Zophar's understanding, he proceeds to pronounce on his philosophy of life with regard to the wicked, of course. And the gist of his speech is that the wicked never prosper for long. That's what he says. The wicked never prosper for long. His mirth and joy, he says, are short-lived. Though his pride reaches to the heavens and his head touches the clouds, he will perish forever on the refuse dump, so that people will have to say, if they recall him at all, where is he? For he is like a dream. A bad dream, we would suppose, you mean, Zophar. A bad dream which is soon gone? Or is it soon gone, Zophar? So that it vanishes, he says, with the night and cannot be found? All that one can see of the wicked, he suggests, is his children in poverty, while he himself, for all his youthful vigor, is soon gone, and his bones reduced to dust. And he then goes on to characterize the wicked in all the vile pleasure of his enjoyment of the evil he hatches. It is to him like a sweet morsel under his tongue, from which he derives so great satisfaction that he cannot bear to swallow it. And he'd better not, for it will turn sour in his stomach, says Zophar, like the venom of the serpent, so that he will retch and vomit to get rid of the vile poison which has filled his belly. Then you see with the second line of verse 15 of chapter 20 what Zophar is getting at. The wicked man is forced by God to disgorge his ill-gotten gains, and all that will be left to him is to suck the poison of serpents, although it will be the fangs of the same adder which will eventually kill him. He has embraced evil, and of course, since evil is deadly, it will kill him. There will be no pleasure for him in the pleasant things of life, such as honey and cream. All that he has toiled for so avariciously has to be given back, uneaten, and there'll be no profit from all his cunning commercialism. And the reason is plain. The wealth he has amassed has been gotten at the expense, says Zophar, of the poor, whom he has been prepared to leave destitute, that he should be furnished with all that his gross and greedy soul craved. He has even robbed people of their homes, houses he never built, says Zophar. And then he tries to describe the spirit which animates such a wicked person. It arises from a deadly craving to acquire and possess, even if the things he amasses don't do him any good or contribute to his true welfare. Well, how could they if they have been dishonestly gained? And so Zophar pictures the wicked as having gorged himself with everything he could lay his hands on, whether honestly or not, until there was nothing left for him to satisfy his lust on. Nothing. And I'm reminded of something that one has said from time to time. Hell is the place of unfulfillable craving, which is a terrible thought. Hell is the place of unfulfillable craving. And it will be just then, Zophar says, in the midst of his plenty, this is his theme, it will be just in the midst of his plenty and his prosperity, like the man in Jesus' story with his barns full, you remember, that the call will come to give up all he has gained and face his Maker. And it is a fearful Maker he has to face, burning with anger and raining blows on him. Nor can the wicked escape this wrathful and vengeful God, for wherever and however he runs, God's arrow finds its mark and pierces him. And even as he pulls it out of his back in agony and sees the sharp point that has penetrated his liver, he panics. And the next episode in his judgment seems to be a spirit of sheer terror which comes over him, in which everything that is dear to him is blotted out, including his treasures, which here are thought to be to refer to his children. And the last calamity is fire. And the awful thing here is that it is not man-made fire. It is fire from heaven. As it were, for him, the last judgment, in which all is devoured. Yes, it is the heavens which will expose his guilt, but it will be earth which will rise up against him. And how true that is. Oh yes, Zophar, you are right there. How true this is. So often in the scriptures, when the crimes of saints and sinners alike are exposed, it is through revelations, insights, and discernments given by God to his servants the prophets that the exposures are made. Nathan to David, you remember. But Zophar's fertile mind, perhaps most fertile, as is alas too often the case, in denouncing others. What a pity that we prostitute our best gift to the unworthiest and vilest of ends, condemning and denouncing others. Zophar's fertile mind also sees the wicked man's final end in other terms. No picture, he would say, is sufficient to describe the awful end of the bad man. He now sees his end as like a flood which carries away his house and presumably all in it, because these waters are the supreme display of the wrath of God. And so Zophar trails off at verse 29. Such is the fate God allots the wicked, the heritage appointed for them by God. And after all that, on the same theme, Zophar deserves a rest. But what a waste of breath. Yes, there has been a modicum of truth here and there, but what a waste of breath. Not because there is no truth in what he says. We shall see how much in a moment when Job turns his trenchant mind on him. Not because there is no truth in what he says, but because, as in all these tirades of these three friends, the messages are applied to the wrong person. The sermon doesn't apply to Job. And a misapplied sermon is such a waste of time and of breath and of effort. And our constant prayer should be that when the word of God is declared and expounded, it should apply to those who are there to hear it. How can we be sure of that? One way only. By depending utterly upon the Holy Spirit. He takes his word, his own word, and applies it to all. And there are none. When the Holy Spirit takes up his word, whatever word it may be, whatever part of the scriptures, none that can escape the searching truth of his holy word. But these men are preaching the wrong sermons to this poor man. And it's awful, and it gets worse as we go on. I suppose it's just as well that we We are suspending these studies after tonight for a time, and God willing, next Sunday evening, we're going to do something that we haven't done for 14 years in church. We're going to read some Psalms, and in the morning, look at 1 Peter. Job then takes up the theme. All this, he says, in chapter 20, verse 22, you see that? About the sudden destruction of the wicked in the very heyday of his success and prosperity. That's bunkum, says Job. The truth is far otherwise. But nonetheless, as usual, Job begins quite patiently. Listen carefully to my words, he says. At least give me that consolation. And if that calls for forbearance on your part, you fellows, you will have opportunity afterwards to mock on when I've finished. But listen now. My complaint is not directed at man. I'm not dealing with you, but I'm seeking to deal with God if he would appear. My complaint is not directed at man. Now, Job, that's a good start. That's a good start. Too many people in the midst of their troubles see them as only on the horizontal level between man and man. And the very thought that there is a spiritual or a heavenly dimension is completely out of their ken. But Job has more sense. And so this is a good point that he makes. His complaint is not directed at man. Well then, he goes on, why should I not be impatient? Have a look at me. Instead of sitting there thinking up your next clever remark to put me in the wrong, have a look at me. Are you not amazed at what you see? Does not the plight I am in so astonish you that the only thing you can think of doing is to clap your hand over your mouth, as you did the first 7 days when you came to see me? Lest you say an unadvised or an inadvertent word to add to my torture. Shut up, in fact, he's saying. And then he goes on, when I think of my situation, it so terrifies me that I tremble all over. But Zophar, addressing him in particular, in answer to your theme of the sudden destruction of the wicked, the truth is the very opposite. They prosper as they grow older and increase in wealth and power. Nothing amiss happens to their families, as happened to mine, he might have said. Their homes are free from danger and fear, nor is the rod of God's chastisement upon them. Nothing like that ever happens to them. And as to their cattle, they never miscarry or fail to breed. And their children become like a flock of happy, carefree lambs that gamble and skip and dance to their heart's delight. Their houses are full of music and merriment, and even in their latter years they continue in prosperity, and even go down to the grave in peace. Not in pieces, as Tom Swanson would say, but in peace, with all the notables of the town at their funerals. They are given a right handsome send-off, the wicked. And, as far as religion is concerned, they have no time for God at all. Everything in their garden is lovely, and they don't need a god to dance attendance on them. They can get on very well without him, thank you very much. Who is this God, anyway, that you recommend? What advantage would it be for us to know him? Would it do any good to pray to him? And here Job can't refrain from confusing his case by putting in a remark which is more in keeping with the 73rd Psalm on the prosperity of the wicked than on his present theme, Their day is coming, he says, although it may not be down here on earth. For their prosperity, much as they may think it, is not in their hands. That's why, he says, I stand aloof from the counsel of the wicked, because although they may survive and apparently prosper all the days of their mortal lives and die in peace and in high honor, I wouldn't be in their shoes for anything afterwards. But then to return, he says, how often is the lamp of the wicked snuffed out? How often does calamity come upon them as the allotment of God's anger? How often are they like straw before the wind, or like chaff swept away in a gale? They say, he remarks, they say, it is said, God stores up a man's punishment for his sons. But Job is not pleased with that. No. Let God repay the man himself, the actual sinner, he says. Ah, but wait a moment, Job. There is Exodus 20 and 5. What about that? Can you recite Exodus 20 and 5 that we in our day used to learn by rote? God says, I am a jealous God as far as worshipping idols is concerned, punishing the children for the sin of the fathers to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me. Ah, yes, says Job. And we imagine he would say, when we raise the question of the punishment of the children of the fathers, ah, yes, but that's not saying that the children will suffer for their father's sins unless they continue in sin as their fathers did. The commandment says, punishing the children for the sin of the fathers to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me. And you couldn't deny that it is punishment for the sins of the fathers, but only as long as the children continue in the sins of their fathers. The scripture that does say that children suffer for their father's sins is Ezekiel 18 and 2, a proverb, the prophet Ezekiel says, which is not to be quoted anymore. Do you remember what it is? The fathers eat sour grapes and the children's teeth. It's the most unreasonable thing in the world, isn't it? The fathers eat sour grapes and the children's teeth are set on edge. That sounds mad, sounds daft, doesn't it? Of course. But it was believed, and it was stated. But Ezekiel says, don't say that anymore. By the way, this word is also found in Jeremiah 31 and 29, where the prophet Jeremy says, and says it after the exile, the people are not to say that anymore, that the fathers eat sour grapes and the children's teeth are set on edge. He says, instead, Jeremiah says, instead, everyone will die for his own sin. Whoever eats sour grapes, his own teeth will be set on edge. That's reasonable, isn't it? And Job says he agrees with that. Let his own eyes see his destruction. Let him drink of the wrath of the Almighty himself. For what does the wicked man care? And this is a terrible thing. What does the wicked man care about his family, the family he leaves behind when his own allotted months come to an end? Is that true? I'm sure it's not always true of the wicked, because sometimes the wicked care for their own very, very dearly. But not always. And this is what Job is saying. And of course, when we read this word about the wicked man not caring about his family after he's gone, we are reminded of one of the kings of Judah. You remember who? It was Hezekiah. And he was one of the best kings, not worst king, of Judah. And we read that the Lord reproached Hezekiah for showing off his treasures to envoys from Babylon. And Hezekiah admitted that he had done so. He said, "They saw everything in my palace." And Isaiah said from the Lord, "Oh, Hezekiah, you foolish fellow, failing to be careful because God has blessed you and you thought you could do what..." When God blesses you, you think you can do what you like? Never. "The time will come," says Isaiah, "when everything in your palace will be carried off to Babylon." And that came true, of course, we know. And when Isaiah said that to King Hezekiah, what do you think Hezekiah said? Oh, this sounds so smooth and unctuous, so oily and sanctimonious that makes me shudder. I don't like to think that good Hezekiah could say something as superficial as this. When Isaiah said, "The time will come when everything in your palace will be carried off to Babylon." But it will be after you are gone. And Hezekiah said, "The word of the Lord you have spoken is good." How good, if everything in his palace is to be carried away to Babylon after he's gone? "The word of the Lord you have spoken is good. Will there not be peace and security in my lifetime?" What a thing to say. Even good King Hezekiah had no thought, apparently, of the evils that would come upon his son. And perhaps, you know, in a sense, it's just as well, for Manasseh, his son, was certainly the wickedest king of Judah. But you see what Job is combating, that the ends are saying. They are saying that the wicked are cut off in the prime of their wickedness. And Job is saying, no, nothing of the sort. They prosper to the end. So he turns on his friends, especially Zophar, whom he is answering, to say, "Can anyone teach knowledge to God, since he judges even the highest? One wicked man dies in full vigor, completely secure and at ease, his body well nourished, his bones rich in marrow." He knew about bone marrow then. "Another man dies in bitterness of soul, never having enjoyed anything good. Side by side they lie in the dust, and worms cover them both as if they were equal." "Now," he says, "now," says Job, "I know what you are thinking and the evil stratagems that you are in your heart to hurt and wrong me. You think you know why these two men died as they did. The one lived a good life, the other a bad. You ask, where now is the great man's house, the tents where the wicked men lived? Are you so ignorant that you have never questioned those who have travelled or paid attention to the accounts they have given of life in the world at large? That the evil man is spared from the day of calamity," says Job, "and delivered from the day of wrath, as far as this world is concerned. That the devil is so careful of his own to the very last minute, lest he lose them to his enemy God." Well, Job doesn't quite say that, because he doesn't know about Satan yet. But he's on the right lines here, is he not? Who in this wicked world, he asks, ever denounces the bad man to his face and repays him for what he has done? And then in one of the most moving and impressive passages in the book, Job characterizes the wicked man who prospers to the end of his mortal life in terms of the very problem of Psalms 73 and 12 and 14, the problem of the prosperity of the wicked. He says, he is carried to the grave, and watch is kept over his tomb. The soil of the valley is sweet to him. What does he mean by that? I think he means that the prosperous wicked man is laid to rest in the grounds of his own estate, which he has tended so lovingly. The soil of the valley is sweet to him. Of course, he's beyond knowing it. And then this, all men follow him, and a countless throng goes before him. What a procession! What a funeral! What a funeral! And in our day, the newspapers and news bulletins would be full of him. He is given, this evil man, a king's send-off. Job doesn't say on his way to hell, because apparently he doesn't fully know about these things. But that's what he would mean if he did know. A glorious send-off. As many a wicked man, illustrious in the eyes of the world, with titles and honors galore, given a most magnificent send-off on his way to hell. Nor do I doubt that such thoughts were not very far from the surface of Job's mind, probing after these deep truths as he was. Therefore, you see, with a certain amount of justifiable satisfaction, Job concludes, "So how can you console me with your nonsense?" Well, Job, console is hardly the word we would use for what these three rascals have said and implied about you. But we are sure you yourself are not above a little biting sarcasm sometimes when you are put to it. So Job ends sweepingly, "Nothing is left of your answers but falsehood." Of course, you might say, and some of you have been thinking this while we've been talking, you might say that Job is equally as wrong as his three friends. Because all wicked men do not prosper to the end, any more than all good men suffer to the end. Job, for instance. Yes, 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 yes. But you see the point of the three. And notably here, Zophar. If it is established as an invariable and inevitable principle that wicked men always come to a bad end in the peak of their prosperity and nefarious activities, and at the height of their ill-gotten gains, then Job, as a bad man, and they're all implying that he's a bad man and suffering for his sins, Job is caught in the inevitability of that inexorable trap, and is therefore infallibly convicted of the fact that he, as they would undoubtedly say he is, infallibly convicted of the fact that he is suffering for his sins. And that's the point that the three so-called friends are laboring to convince the man of. They know, of course they know, that not all bad men suffer for their sins on earth. any more than all good men prosper to the end of their days. These three are simply using this ridiculous philosophy, and Zophar in particular at this point, using this ridiculous philosophy that bad men invariably suffer on earth for their sins, because it puts poor Job in the corner they want him to be in. They want to corner him and convince him that he's suffering for his sins, which is so viciously cruel when you know what God has said about Job's blamelessness. So viciously cruel that I cannot think of anything even today which is more heinous than that. To kick a man when he is down shows a level of savagery which, to my mind, is the equal of any of the atrocities we read of today in the Middle East or the Far East or in Ulster. It's the same spirit as that of Belson. And it can only come from the depth of the pit. But it would seem to me that men who frankly enjoy the accumulated sufferings and mortal agonies of their fellow human beings, not to speak of what they do to the brute beasts, men who frankly enjoy the accumulated sufferings of their fellow human beings as an exquisite pleasure, and they do. The devil sees to that. It gives them exquisite pleasure and satisfaction to exercise that diabolical lust for cruelty and hurt. They love it. And it seems to me that they are already so far gone in wickedness that they approximate to the depravity of the unpardonable sin. I'm not saying they commit it, but they approximate, they approach the depravity, the sheer depravity of the unpardonable sin. That is, to call that which is holy evil and that which is evil good. When one has gone so far along the road that one sees what is good as evil and one sees what is evil as good, I believe one has gone beyond redemption and is damned before one dies. That's exactly where the devil is. And it is that which caused him to be tufted out of heaven and to land on his face with his tail flailing in the air, doing all the damage it possibly can do before his vile serpentine head is forever bruised until the final ignominy, that of living in the nether regions of the hell God has prepared for him, so that he be trampled down by all, think of this, trampled down by all the underlings of the pit, who will then see their hero. The devil doesn't reign in hell, he's in the lowest pit. Even lower than his underlings, and they're trampling him down. So you see, in the study of these two chapters, we all have an excellent opportunity, and there's a very hard tension in this tonight. I don't know that you like it, but I believe it to be true. We, in our study in these two chapters, we have an excellent opportunity to exercise what I call that counterpart of love to Jesus. That counterpart of love to Jesus, which is a sure sign that our love to the Lord is true. Now, what would be a sure sign that our love to the Lord is really true? A healthy hatred of the devil and all his works. You've heard of the two sides of a penny. There they are. They belong together. And friends, to come short of that loathing could be a sign that we come short of its counterpart, namely love to the Lord. They belong together. So that this may be a test of how deep our love may be. We are so embarrassed by evil that we don't want to talk about it or think about it or even pray about it, which is worse of all. And it's a terrible failure of Christ's church today. These two belong together. Hatred. Not vengeance. Oh, be careful. Not vengeance. Hatred of evil and of a personal devil. Vengeance is not ours, but abhorrence of evil and pure hatred. Yes, pure sheer hatred of the devil is the companion of our love of Jesus. And it might be a good thing for us to test these two together every day.